This Veterans Radio program is dedicated to the men and women who served in the wild blue yonder of the United States Air Force.
From the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host, Bob Gould.
Yeah, good morning, Veterans Radio audience. So this is Bobby G., Bob Gould, right here calling you up early in the morning. Hope you got your coffee. We got quite a program today, but we are broadcasting from the Ave Maria Network right here in beautiful, and it's a beautiful day, and Ann Arbor, Michigan. So stay tuned. We're going to be talking about bombers. I hear a lot about that. Bombers, bombers, bombers. What about our bombers? What's going on? Well, we're going to have Dr. Rebecca Grant. She's going to be on the program. She's going to answer all those questions. It's been her third visit. So we will have that in just a moment. In the meantime, oh, by the way, if you have a question, I have a question for Dr. Grant during the program today. Please call us at 877-573-7825. That's 877-573-7825. Well, close by, about 3 miles from the studio, actually, got a big piece of land. Used to be called the Bomber Factory. The Ford Motor Company set it together. They made a whole bunch of B-24s at the Willow Run Airport. And right here in Ypsilanti, Michigan, they do have a B-52. That's right, a static display. But I'm not going to give it all away because they're going to have an open house and air show, Thunder Over Michigan. With me right now is my guest, Mr. Bob Catalano from the Yankee Air Museum. Bob, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thanks, Bob. Good morning.
Are you still in the van?
I'm still in the van. Yes, I am.
Oh, I love all this technology. Well, okay, you have an annual air show. A lot of folks.
Yes, we do.
That's, well, an annual. A lot of folks haven't made up their mind, their vacation plans. So you have something coming up in August. Why don't you, Thunder Over Michigan, why don't you tell our listeners about that?
Sounds good, Bob. On August 4th and 5th, we have our annual Thunder Over Michigan. And this year it's going to be very exciting. We have our Mustang Mania. We're going to have over 20 P-51 Mustangs in attendance. So that should be pretty cool, and we have, just to name a few, airplanes in attendance. We have Fifi, the only flying B-29 Super Fortress.
Wow, that's going to be that's going to be there on site?
Yep, sure is, and you could actually go for a ride on it.
It
costs
no, really?
A couple pennies to do it, but yeah, they're going to have it. You can go for a ride. We're going to have a F-86F Sabre called Smokey. He'll be doing a demo flight. And one of the coolest things actually came in on Monday is a FA-2 Sea Harrier. And, Bob, it's the only privately owned Harrier anywhere. This fellow bought it off the British government, and he's the only person that could fly, a civilian that could fly a Sea Harrier. So that's really cool.
He didn't find it in a yard sale.
I don't think so. I don't think so.
Outside of one of the air bases. Tell me this again. A B-29 is going to be on site, and you could take a ride in that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Fifi, she will be there. She travels the country and attending air shows and giving rides to us civilians. So it's pretty cool.
And you're going to have a reenactment of about 300 reenactors on a World War II battle scene, complete with fighter protection. Why don't you fill a little bit in on that? Whoa.
Yeah, last year we did, it was a salute to the Navy, so we did the Pacific Theater last year. So this year it's going to be the European Theater, and they're going to have reenactors with support, as you said, with the P-51 Mustangs participating. So that'll be really neat.
And, man, that ought to,
it's a great show. It's an incredible show our director puts on.
Are those reenactors both Saturday and Sunday?
I believe it is going to be both days.
Okay, now give us those dates again.
Okay, it's August 4th and 5th. The gates open at 9 a.m. They close at 4 p.m.
Oh,
and the air show starts at noon and runs till 4.
And there are plenty of hotel rooms around if you need that. Is that correct?
Right. We have all kinds of hotels in the area, and they're more than happy to put you up for the weekend.
And there is parking, right?
There is parking. Actually, right now, if you pay for your parking now, it's $5 in advance. $10 the day of the show.
How do they pay in advance? What do they got to do?
You go to our website. It's www.yankeeairmuseum.org, and you'll see the button for Thunder Over Michigan. You can click on that, and it'll give you all the information for parking, advance tickets, the whole nine yards, the planes that are going to be in attendance. And basically everything you need to know.
Yeah, and I know that the tickets aren't big bucks. Were they $5 or something? And kids under 12 are free?
Well, like I said, the parking is $5, $10 a day of. Now, the tickets are, the discount tickets are $25
a day. Oh, they are? Okay.
But yeah, they're $30 a day of, but kids under 15 and under, I should say, are free with an adult ticket purchase.
Okay.
So you can bring the kids, you can, you know, get one ticket and bring 10 kids in with you if they're under 15 and under. So
you can pack up the babies and grab grandma and grandpa, especially grandpa, who would
That's
love
right.
to see that. I know I was out there a couple of years ago when you had Jack Roush and the Old Crow, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
He went up, I don't know how many feet, 5,000,
yeah.
10,000. You could see him going up and up till he was just a dot. And
yep.
he threw that stick, forward, pulled it back, and then he came down screaming and pulled out to within, I swear, 200 feet of the deck. I mean, everybody's hair, if you had any hair, was just raised. I mean, to watch that powerful P-50, and you're going to have 20 of them. Wow.
20 plus, actually.
So bring
yeah.
your camera, right?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. This is totally a photographic event, something to see. You just don't see that many Mustangs flying in one place, and certainly you don't get your chance every day to see a Sea Harrier, that's for sure.
And will that Harrier be demonstrated?
Yep, he'll be doing a demo flight, and we actually got to see him come in on Monday. He brought the plane in on Monday, and it was pretty exciting. He made a bunch of passes around the airport, around Willow Run, and then he came in, he transitioned, and stood there just hanging in the air. So it was
hanging in the air, literally and figuratively, that's for sure.
Exactly, yes.
And
literally and figuratively.
We're going to be, talk about timing, we're going to be talking with Dr. Grant in just a moment about the future of bombers, but also the past bombers. My favorite, mm-hmm. things I really love to see, and that is buff. You know what that is, the B-52.
Oh, sure too.
And
yep.
you have one there, so if you want to get a photo standing next to a B-52, you can do it. August 4th and 5th at the Willow Run Airport. Real quick, give us your website. There we go.
Our website, www.yankeeairmuseum.org. You can find out everything about the museum, everything about the air show, everything about everything that is Yankee-related.
Okay, and also, folks, are you there? Check out the Adopt a Plane program. Wouldn't that be cool
right.
if your group got... Well, we'll talk about that, Bob, in a future program. Thank you very much for being on the program. And I will, if I don't talk to you sooner, I will see you there at Thunder Over Michigan. You have a great
Sounds
day.
Good. Hope to see everyone there. Thank you.
Wow. What is that? Man, that's really, and that's quite a large, plenty of bathrooms and lots of food and lots of walk around. But if you do, make sure you bring something. You got to wear a hat, folks, because you're out there. There's a lot of runway, and you definitely want to have comfortable shoes. So anyway, we're going to be right back with Dr. Rebecca Grant. We're going to be talking about those bombers and the bomber fleet right after this short message.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
Yes, off we go into the wild blue yonder, and off we go with our program today with Dr. Rebecca Grant, who, as I said before, has been on the program. This is, I believe, her third visit. Dr. Grant is president of IRIS Independent Research, and she is going to start off our program today by speaking about her recommendation, and she did a report on the case for the stealth bomber. She wrote about the Air Force's bomber fleet and the replacement with a stealth bomber. Now, think about this, folks. This is the B-2 cost about $2.5 billion. That's a lot of money. They got about 20 of these. Okay, replace that. But with the plane that Dr. Grant will be speaking about, it's only $600 million. But 200 of them, that's a big investment. And with the austerity programs that we have now, with the budget, Well, Dr. Grant, welcome to Veterans Radio. Take it from there.
Bob, good morning. I'm glad to be back on your program, especially talking about bombers. I know we'll talk a little history in a few minutes, but let me bring you up to date on a really exciting new development this year. The Air Force has put into place a program to develop a new stealth bomber. We'd expect to see this bomber fly probably either very late this decade or just early into the next decade. And I want to tell you why this is so important, having this new bomber program. It's really the first new bomber program in 30 years. We talked a little bit about the B-2, and the B-2 is currently the most modern bomber out there. There are only 20 of them. One was lost in a crash. We only have 20. But the B-2 was developed in the very early 1980s. The designs were done in 1980, 1981. The contract was won by Northrop at the time in 1981, and they built it through the 80s. The plane first flew in 1989. And, Bob, I don't know what you were doing in 1989, but that was a pretty long time ago for me. And it's a long time in terms of the changes in technology. So the good news is the Air Force has started this program. It's a very secret program right now. They have some industry teams who have been awarded contracts to try out designs on paper for what this new bomber would look like. And we don't really have very many more details than that. What we do know is the Pentagon really wants to keep this program affordable. It's so important for our ongoing global conventional and nuclear deterrence to have this new bomber so that we can start to replace some of the older bombers in the triad. So affordability is a key goal. The Pentagon has said, let's try to keep this cost at about $550 million per aircraft. That sounds like a lot of money to me, probably does to you as well, but it's not outlandish at all. If you're looking at buying an airliner, for example, they'll run you in the $200 million range. So a bomber, of course, much more sophisticated, more capable. They're going to try to keep it at about $550 million.
Now, this bomber, that Bomber X, if we should call it that, that you are proposing, it has a whole different capability. It's more long strike, correct? And also reconnaissance. Is there something there to be tied in?
Yeah, good question about reconnaissance. So the new bomber, its main role will be long-range strike and, of course, carrying a heavy payload. So what we really want this new bomber to do is to be able to get in with the toughest air defenses that we might see in a future conflict, really over the next 30 to 40 years. So it has to be real good at what it does. You know, we've had very active air operations in Iraq and Afghanistan, doing a lot of support, fire support for forces on the ground in particular. But the thing about Iraq before it and Afghanistan now is there's no air defense threat. That's really different from what we saw in Desert Storm 20 years ago, even back in Vietnam. And there are very sophisticated air defenses around the world. Russia has built and sold a lot of them. There are two pieces to an air defense. One are the surface-to-air missiles. We'll talk about those later in the program. And then, of course, there are fighters. And as we know, China is flight testing a stealth fighter of its own. So these trends don't tell us where we might fight, but they tell us the kind of technical threats that are out there. This bomber, the new stealth bomber, has to be built to prevail over those threats. Now, we also want it to be able to pick up information in the battle space. And this is something really different from the days when the B-52 was designed back in the late 40s and early 50s. Today, because of the radars and sensors that are out there that aircraft carry, you can design a bomber that's going to go ahead and sweep up a lot of information. What kind of information? Well, information on the threats in the area, information on what the targets look like, and the neat thing is we've now figured out ways to be able to pass that information back to other aircraft, pass it back to the command post. So any bomber, I think, is going to have a strong capability for intelligence and reconnaissance and surveillance
now,
along with its other missions.
Now, this is not going to be like the U-2. They'll be able to go in at low altitude. Is that correct?
Well, it won't look like the U-2. The U-2, the high-altitude spy plane, is such a unique configuration, and it's very light. You know, that's about a 30,000-pound airframe. With these bombers, we're talking, 150,000, 200,000 pounds. So, real different look. But a great thing for a bomber is to use high altitude. Now, the bombers we have today are very capable at low altitude also. And I think this new one will be. But high altitude is really a sweet spot for a bomber. And if it's a good, powerful four-engine bomber, it should do very well up in that airspace, way above where the Alaranis fly, so up in the 40,000, 50,000-foot airspace. Well, I'd expect this to be a high-altitude bomber.
Now, the question that comes to my mind is, right now the B-1 or the B-2 bomber can fly right through the defenses. But wouldn't it be that with cruise missiles, a bomber in the future would not have to get that close, that kind of penetration? Is that true?
Oh, we wish that were the case. For some targets, that's true. If you have a target that doesn't move and isn't heavily buried underground, so let's say something like a communications tower. It's in one place, you know where it is, something like that, you may be able to use a cruise missile against it. But the most difficult targets are targets that move around. And all the modern missile systems and missile launchers for a couple decades now have been road mobile. So the problem there is you may launch a cruise missile, but in the time it takes that missile to fly into the target, your surface-to-air missile battery can put the keys in the ignition and drive off several kilometers, and the cruise missile misses it. So when you talk about a penetrating bomber, it means a couple things. And one thing that it means is the bomber has to get close enough to launch a weapon with good velocity and to hit a mobile target before it can move out of the lethal range of the bomb. They call that direct attack in the Air Force.
And you further state that this is going to be in the future now. We're talking about preventive I think is what we can say, and it's going to be mostly looking at the Pacific Theater. Is that correct?
It will be a global mission, obviously, but there are threats and concerns in the Pacific that have really got our attention. One sign of that is the country has had a continuous bomber presence on Guam for almost 10 years now. We've kept bombers there a few at a time, ready to go, and they fly missions all over the Pacific. So what we want to do in the Pacific is to be able to deter any rising military powers, like China, for example. You know, we're also going to have diplomatic relations and trade relations with China, but we also want to deter. That's part of our underlying strategy, to keep the balance in the Pacific. So a bomber is an important part of that conventional balance. And that will be a top mission for this next stealth bomber.
I don't think my listeners know, and I certainly didn't, that the Chinese now are in production with a stealth bomber.
They are in test with a stealth fighter. It's funny. It looks a lot, from some angles, like the U.S. Air Force's F-22 Raptor. So the Chinese and other nations, Russia as well, is working on stealth technology. They've been paying attention to how successful stealth technologies have been for the U.S. Air Force, and they want to do more of the same. So it's essential to keep up with this. I think the other thing, perhaps people don't always realize, is that we only have 20 stealth bombers. They're good. The B-2 is a very, very capable aircraft. It's used in nuclear deterrence. It can launch nuclear weapons. It can also launch conventional weapons. And it did that for the first time back in 1999 when NATO fought the former Yugoslav Republic over the province of Kosovo. It was very successful. But only 20 aircraft. It's just not enough. The plans had been to have 75 or 100 of the B-2s. And as the Cold War ended, those plans changed. So the basic fact is these B-2s are really used a lot. I want to point back to spring of 2011 when two interesting things went on at the same time involving the bombers. One was the beginning of the Libya operation. And B-2s were used to strike on the first couple days at some of the key air defense targets because they could get in there safely and take those targets out. At the same time, what we know now is the planning for the raid on Osama bin Laden was underway. And we know that the SEAL teams went in there and did that with helicopters. But do you remember the backup plan for that was to use B-2 bombers to destroy the compound. So if you were the B-2 squadron out at Whiteman Air Force Base, Missouri, in the spring of 2011, you had about 16 aircraft planning to do two different operations in different spots of the world. And that really shows you how in demand these bombers are. And these were for what we would call, you know, certainly had they been used in a counterterrorism scenario. That's sort of a low-intensity conflict. That's the kind of thing that can go on just about any time. So the bottom line is, first of all, the Air Force just needs more stealth bombers. And second, they need now to design a new one that will go on and improve on what the B-2 does and give us conventional deterrence out for the next 20, 30, 40 years.
Now, in watching the military channel, I saw a program on stealth technology. I got the impression that, well, that was then, and we may not be using that in the future. That, it didn't quite say that, but that was the impression I got from the program. And our Bomber X here is a stealth bomber. Maybe you could just very quickly touch on the future of stealth technology.
Yeah, there are a lot of questions about that. I think the most the best sign of the future is how many stealth aircraft are currently in development. The Air Force, Navy, Marine Corps, and several of our allies are working together on the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter, which is a stealth design. And, of course, we have the F-22, the B-2, and we have a design now for a new stealth bomber. At the same time, we see China and Russia working to figure out stealth technology. So that tells me it's still very relevant. What stealth does is it makes it much harder for radar to detect an aircraft, and that's something that we're going to need for a long time. I'd say stealth is now just a basic entering argument for combat aircraft. It's still very relevant. There are other ways to help defend a bomber or a fighter, and we'll make use of all those, electronic warfare, all sorts of things that go with that. But stealth is just a foundation now for modern combat aircraft, and we think it will be for a long time. As long as enemy fighters and enemy surface-to-air missiles use radar, we will be using stealth.
Well, I'm speaking with Dr. Rebecca Grant, president of IRIS, that's capital, IRIS. I get that right, IRIS, Independent Research. Dr. Grant, we're going to get back with you in just a moment. We're coming up to a break, but before we do that, tell us a little bit about IRIS, Independent Research.
Right. IRIS Independent Research is a defense consulting firm here in Washington, D.C. We've done work for the Air Force, the Navy, and several aerospace firms over the last many years. Passion, obviously, is research on the future of air power and on how it contributes to our national strategy.
And you're working on what right now? The Bomber X? Is that the main focus of IRIS?
We've done a project on that. We're also doing some work on future unmanned air vehicle trends and work on the industrial base, the defense industrial base. Got several projects cooking.
Well, folks, she is married with a 5-year-old daughter, and I understand you ride drive motorcycles. Is that right?
Yes, I have my lovely Kawasaki Cruiser still out there, right, parked right next to my car.
Yes, ma'am, and you can go and visit Dr. Grant and give out that website again.
It's www.irisresearch.com, irisresearch.com.
And does that IRIS have to be capitaled?
No, lowercase is fine, and from that website you can read the paper that was released recently on the case for a new stealth bomber.
Yes, and anything else, if you want to Google Dr. Rebecca Grant, you can find a whole bunch of stuff. Wonderful reading, and so informative. Okay, we're right here on Veterans Radio. We'll be getting back with Dr. Grant. Go ahead and have a glass of water. You covered a lot of territory, okay? We'll be right back. We'll be right back with Dr. Grant and talking about the B-52, the B-1, and the B-2 right after this.
Did you have to shoot anyone?
You gonna get a job now or what?
No one knows what it's like to come back from Iraq or Afghanistan unless they were there. Join other veterans at communityofveterans.org, brought to you by Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Okay, you're listening to Veterans Radio right here on WDEO 990 AM or on the website veteransradio.net. I don't know, I'm reading the wrong stuff here, folks. veteransradio.net. You can go on our website and listen to Veterans Radio, or you can pick it up terrestrially, 990 AM. Yeah, I like that. That's Nielsen Schmielsen. I love that bump music. Okay, I'm back with Dr. Grant. Dr. Grant, the president of IRIS, Air Force Independent Research. And she was on the program the other night. I almost fell out of my couch. The top 10 bombers. Number one, of course, was the B-52. I definitely want to talk about that. Dr. Grant, get us started.
The B-52, how could it not be the number one bomber? It's got such a combat record, for one thing. I want to mention right at the beginning here, I was privileged to get to fly in a B-52 with the 23rd Bomb Squadron, which is based at Minot Air Force Base in North Dakota. They're part of the 5th Bomb Wing. We have two bomb wings in the U.S., one at Minot, one at Louisiana. And I was privileged to fly with this crew on a training mission from Guam. We got to participate in an exercise called Cope North, where the Japanese and the Australians were there as well, lots of American planes, simulating attack and defense on the country of Northlandia, obviously a fictional country, but this is what our airmen do. They took me along on their mission, flying in a big air battle with about 30 or 40 other aircraft. I was delighted to see the B-52 up close. You know, Bob, one thing that surprised me, you've been in the cockpit, but that bomber is all business. They didn't design a lot of room for the crew. It's a narrow hatch. You have to swing yourself up into the hatch, and then you've got the pilot on the left, the co-pilot seat on the right. I was fortunate to sit in the fold-down instructor pilot seat, so I was just behind the pilot and to his left.
Oh, woo.
That was really a lovely, lovely view of the Pacific. Guam has an unusual runway that's partly made of coral, so it's white and gleaming. It also has a dip in the center. And to see that on takeoff and on landing was very exciting indeed. The B-52 is all gray. And although it's a big, big aircraft with a wingspan of 185 feet, it's got a surprisingly delicate look to it. It's very aerodynamic. I was surprised how quickly the aircraft just sprang off the runway. You're used to an airliner going down, it takes time, and the runway distance markers roll. This B-52 just leapt into the air, and I got to fly a really terrific two-and-a-half-hour mission with a young crew, pilot, co-pilot, a navigator, and radar operator, you know, electronic warfare systems operator, crew of five total, and they were just terrific. A lot of them had just joined the Air Force within the last couple years.
And where do you come from something like that? You come directly from the Air Force Academy?
You know, I think there was one Academy graduate, perhaps two, but they all had degrees in math or physics. A couple of them had done previous jobs in the Air Force, technical jobs, with their physics degrees. For instance, the electronic warfare officer, who was a female captain, said that what she liked about flying the B-52 was she really got to use her physics degree in action. And it's her job to send out the electronic beams that help spoof potential enemy defenses. So very sophisticated. They spend about a day before they fly planning their mission, where they'll go and exact altitudes, tactics, working with the rest of the big strike package. Then they have a long debriefing, and of course, those aircraft would not get into the air without their maintainers and their crew chiefs. The folks from Minot are very experienced. Some of them have worked on the B-52 for 10 or 15 years. And when you're talking about flying an aircraft that is as old as the B-52, this October, the youngest B-52 will turn 50.
Well, and some of the, first of all, was it loud inside?
It was loud in a good way.
Well,
the power of those engines is great. And, of course, you wear earplugs and earphones over top of that.
Oh, okay. Okay, well, yeah.
So a lot of protection, and then you have the intercom. And I think it's not giving away any secrets to say that my B-52 crew had figured out a way to rig up an iPod on the intercom system in the airplane. So there was some pretty loud rock music coming on.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. It's a long... Well, that must be way cool. You hear
it was
that?
Way cool.
Right,
really
right.
Brought it into the 21st century.
Reverberating, yes. And I'm sure that the pilot and co-pilot, maybe all the crew, had not been alive when the B-52 became deployed, right?
Oh, that's right. They were all much younger than the aircraft that they were in.
So this is their father's airplane.
It's their grandfather's airplane.
Grandfather.
For some of them. Mm-hmm.
Now, my brother was in SAC in 1955, and he surreptitiously he was in intelligence. What is that? F2. G2, my name is G2.
Sure, in the 2 section.
Yeah, and he would come back with black and white photos, smuggle them home, I guess, and to show us. And I remember looking at the B-47. Was that built by Boeing?
Yes, it was, actually.
Okay.
It was designed just actually a little bit before the B-52. They were sort of done right in there together, and B-47 had a wonderful long lifespan as well, as a nuclear deterrent bomber.
Now, wasn't that the same design factors? Wasn't that in a smaller scale from the B-47 that they used to dovetail into the B-52?
Yeah, there was some cross flow. You know, in those days, they would start a bomber project like they did with the B-47. They started actually right at the end of World War II on that one, and then quickly decided that, you know, they wanted some additional range and some, you know, different engines. And when they would have those quick changes come along, then just a few years later, they start off designing the B-52, you know, and work begins on that about 4 years, well, really just 2 to 3 years after they start designing the B-47. So the B-52 was designed for range, and it has an unrefueled range of 8,800 miles. It's amazing. That aircraft, as I said before, not much room for people because that is a place to put fuel and bombs, and tremendously versatile.
And I don't even want to get into the bomb payload because I'm sure it's tremendous. You know, when they 40,000, I don't even understand how to extrapolate that. So, but what I do want to cover again is can a B-52 leave a base, let's say in Fargo, and bomb with enough refueling anywhere in the world?
Absolutely, anywhere in the world. And, of course, the B-52 was developed at the same time that air-to-air refueling became possible. So a typical mission, the crew that I flew with, the 23rd Bomb Squadron, has just done what they call a global power mission, where they flew on a training exercise from North Dakota to Europe and met up with folks from the French Air Force and made a simulated run against a target and came back. Now, how they do that is with air refueling. So they plan for the route of the bomber, and tankers meet them en route. And these two enormous aircraft, the bomber tucks right under to within just a few yards of the tanker, and the boom comes down, and they take fuel flowing at about 2,000 pounds a minute into the bomber, and the bomber goes on its way.
And when they're you call this a show of force, but that's like, hey, potential enemy or anybody who wants to aggravate us, take a look, because this is out there. Can the B-2 also take off from the U.S. and has that been done to have a bombing mission somewhere in the world other than let's say to Afghanistan?
Yes, it has. The B-2s take off from Whiteman Air Force Base. Their very first combat mission, which was in March of 1999, over the Republic of Yugoslavia, was flown from Whiteman, and they flew, did the bombing, and came back. They had four air refuelings on the way to make that happen. Super long missions, and they do that quite frequently. They did that for Afghanistan. In that case, they actually landed briefly in theater without shutting down the engines and then came back. They also flew these missions in March of 2011 for the Libya campaign. So that is real global reach and global power to be able to take off from a U.S. base, hit a target anywhere, and come back.
Now, some of the statements that I can attribute to your research and you in talking with the public and with the press is that we could have 30 more years of use with the B-52.
Yes, that's what the Air Force says, and that's based on the structural life of that aircraft. It is really, really well built. And Boeing did a super job in engineering it, and it's been able to take those stresses. They actually beefed it up a little bit during the early part of the production run. So based on the fatigue loads on the bomber, the Air Force believes they can keep it flying with some safety upgrades along the way until at least 2045. It's just amazing. That would be almost 90 years since the type was introduced.
But it doesn't have any stealth. And here we're going to be developing, right for the future, this bomber X that you're talking about, the stealth bomber, yet the B-52 has no stealth. However, you can look at it and say, well, we're not ready to take this thing out and mothball it out to a desert in Arizona. We want to keep using it. How can you make that happen?
Right. It doesn't have any stealth, but it does have electronic warfare capability. And it has something you mentioned earlier, and that are the cruise missiles. So the B-52 still has a nuclear deterrent role. It's part of our nuclear triad, along with the ground-based and sea-based intercontinental ballistic missiles. The B-52 can do that nuclear deterrence mission. It has two types of weapons. It has nuclear weapons that you put in the bomb bay and drop out, and it also has weapons that are launched from under the wing. So that gives it a nuclear deterrent role, and it's able to perform that mission still. also, it's had a lot of use in conventional operations, going right back from to Vietnam and through Operation Desert Storm in 1991, and then again in Afghanistan. So the B-52 has become relevant in whole new ways as a close air support weapon.
And also, folks, if you're talking 60 years, right? Is it 60? Is that what the B-52 right now? 60?
The B-52s there now are just a little over 50 years old.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, all those ups and downs, folks, when you go to pressure, depressure, that does, as Dr. Grant mentioned, put stresses on those joints. Do you know of any program? I mean, obviously they have something, but can you describe to our listeners what some of that might be to check for those stress cracks in the welds from all those ups and downs?
Sure. Well, the first thing about the B-52 is it's strong, but it's also flexible. In fact, the wings flex quite a bit, depending on how much fuel is on board. It's not something you'd really notice, but it really does have the ability to move and flex. And aircraft are all stress tested to see that they can take quite a bit of stress. But what they really do is it's very, very carefully maintained. So the maintainers and the crew chiefs will inspect on a regular basis. They literally look at the engine mounts. They look at the bomb bay. They look around the landing gear. And they look for the tiny cracks or signs of corrosion that would signal a problem. So they're able to get on top of all that pretty quickly. And what they're finding is it has just been a tremendously strong aircraft. Now, a lot of the cockpit instrumentation has been updated. Not the throttles, though. All eight of them still sit there in this huge array.
And that's where
like
pilot,
the inside of a typewriter.
That pilot has to throw those
that's
throttles
right.
forward with his
pilot and co-pilot
with his together. With his
yeah.
hands, folks.
Yep, all eight at once. But it's the constant work by the maintenance forces, who are the enlisted men of the U.S. Air Force, so the enlisted maintainers of the 5th Bomb Wing and the 2nd Bomb Wing. They are the ones who get the credit for keeping this aircraft going.
We have just a few minutes before the third break, and I want to talk about, you mentioned here, you put in your notes to me, crosswind crab. Talk about that.
Right. Just a little bit back of those throttles is a really unique thing. The crosswind crab allows the B-52 to point its nose into the wind on landing, but to swivel the landing gear a little bit. That means that the B-52 can land when there's a crosswind, as there often is at a base, at a deployed base. This was pretty neat during the Cold War because it meant that the B-52 could fly into a whole lot of places and bases that maybe the Russians weren't expecting. So even if there were winds coming across the runway, this plane could land safely. It was a neat invention and something that's still used on the B-52 today. It's no longer the big secret that it once was, but it's allowed, the crosswind crab has really allowed the B-52 to fly into all sorts of airfields over time.
Way cool. Way cool, folks. We'll be right back with Dr. Grant speaking about now. We're going to go into, we still want to cover the B-52 in Vietnam. So we'll come back from this very short break talking with Dr. Grant about the B-52 in Vietnam and the B-1 and B-2 bombers. Don't you go away.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy?
For freedom.
Freedom of religion.
What America stands for.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy? For honor.
Everybody. And watch out for everybody.
Freedom to vote.
Democracy.
Freedom to go outside and play with my kids.
I joined the Navy to serve my country.
Every freedom that we have.
The right to raise our kids in peace.
My little brother.
My wife. My kids.
Our children's children.
The United States Navy.
It's not for ourselves alone that we serve.
It's time to find a job, but where do you start? Why not begin with the U.S. Air Force? We offer comprehensive job training, we help with advanced education costs, and we'll give you real job experience. So if you've got big dreams, let the Air Force help you get them off the ground. For more information, call 1-800-423-USAF or log on at airforce.com. Cross into the blue with the U.S. Air Force. No one comes close.
Yeah, we're We're back on Veterans Radio for the next 15 minutes. Don't go away. Mm-hmm. And with me is Dr. Rebecca Grant, who has been covering the bomber fleet as well as what's in the future. She is president of IRIS Independent Research. Dr. Grant, welcome. Segment three. Okay. One thing I wanted to talk about, because we all have seen this, the B-52 in Vietnam. When I read accounts of that, that it was such fear in the Viet Cong, they didn't even have to be that close to the actual impact, but the waves, the shock waves would TMI, I think it's called, rattle their brains, and blood would come out of their ears and come out of their nose. So it was a fearful weapon. Tell us about the B-52 in Vietnam. What was its role?
Really a ferocious aircraft. Starting in 1965, the B-52 was used to attack targets, to attack enemy targets. And the first one was done in June that year, and it was an attack of 27 B-52s dropping bombs on what was described as a Viet Cong jungle sanctuary north of Saigon. The way that the bombs went down, it would probably be about a 500-pound bomb dropped in strings across this target. Almost unimaginable force as this is going on. Observers later said it looked like an angry giant had torn through the earth, trees uprooted, craters. Oftentimes, a bombing attack like that would unmask buried fortifications. Just incredible, incredible effect and devastation. I think, you know, what's interesting is there was a 173rd Airborne Brigade was there in that time period in the late 1960s, and one of their commanding generals talked about seeing the B-52 in action. He says, you know, I've observed several dozen strikes. The strike comes at the appointed moment, hits exactly where we asked it to. They are accurate. They are extremely good. So when the ground commanders saw the impact that B-52s had, they would request these strikes to use against enemy positions and enemy fortifications.
Now, that was a role, and will that same role, similar to that, close air support, will that be part of the next three decades that you were talking about, and its role with our military strategy?
Yes, Bob, because it wasn't only the enemy that was impressed by the power of those B-52 strikes. People who were impressed included some young captains at the time, with names like H. Norman Schwarzkopf, who became commander of the forces in Desert Storm, young Colin Powell, and other Army officers who saw what the B-52 could do against massed enemy formations in particular. So for Operation Desert Storm, 1991, Schwarzkopf plans, the first thing he wants from the air component is to be sure that B-52s will be used against the massed Iraqi frontline forces at the appointed moment. And he waits a little bit until he's destroyed, used the aircraft to destroy other types of targets. And then Schwarzkopf says, all right, first we're going to release some pamphlets and tell these Iraqi frontline soldiers who are there in Kuwait on the border that the attacks are coming. So they drop the leaflets, and then about a day later come the bombing attacks. And these are Iraqi forces that Saddam Hussein has sent there. They can't retreat. They can't move. They have to simply endure these attacks. And what they saw right away was desertions beginning from the front lines. But it was the Vietnam experience that impressed Schwarzkopf. He remembered what he saw as a young captain in Vietnam, and he wanted to unleash that effect from the B-52s again.
And I'm sure what a lot of our soldiers who were ready to attack at that point, they also saw the power of that. But these Iraqis, they were the conscript. So you still get blown up just the same. However, why wasn't it used against the Republican Guard? When they did go through and they blew through the conscripts and they were surrendering all over the place, and then there were the Republican Guards. Now, do you know of some reason why that wasn't, or maybe it was, used on the Republican Guards?
Yeah, they were used. The B-52s in Desert Storm attacked a really big variety of targets, some fixed targets, classic strategic bombing, but they were used against all elements of the Iraqi ground forces, both the regular units and the elite Republican Guards that you mentioned. If it was a case of going after specific tanks, they tended to use different aircraft, but the B-52 certainly laid strings of bombs against the Republican Guards as well. You know what's interesting, though, Bob, is by the time we get to Afghanistan in 2001 and then the second Iraq War in 2003, the B-52s now have a new role, something they didn't have in Desert Storm, and that is precision bombing. So early on in Afghanistan, as early as the fall of 2001, remember the conflict started in October 7th of 2001, there were controllers on the ground, mostly Air Force Special Forces, who could contact the B-52 and say, I want you to drop one precision 2,000-pound bomb on this target over here, on this Taliban strong point.
Now, just very, I want to interrupt here. I know I'm interrupting folks, but I do want to ask. So they're on station. The B-52s are on station, correct?
Correct, exactly.
I didn't know that.
You know what they call it? They call it their vul period, their vulnerability period, which means the period that they are tasked to be ready to take action. So they'll be on station, and they can. The great thing about them, they had to fly out of bases like Diego Garcia, which we leased from the British. So pretty long flight to get into up over Afghanistan, but then they could stay on station for a couple of hours, 3, 4, 5 hours or more with refueling. So they would be there just waiting, essentially, for a call from the ground to say, here are the coordinates. Because the B-52 was now able to drop the JDAM, Joint Direct Attack Munition, it uses the satellite GPS signals to drop on very precise GPS coordinates that are handed off from the ground to the aircraft, reprogrammed to the bomb, and down it goes, right where the ground controller wants it.
So there was somebody on ground that wanted to have a precision strike, and they could phone that up.
They could radio that up, and here's an even better part. There were people like U.S. Air Force Master Sergeant Bart Decker, who were working with Afghan rebels who were on our side, and Decker rode a horse with his Afghan compatriots, and he was there on horseback calling through the radio up to the B-52. He's a attack controller, and he would relay the coordinates and the briefing up to that aircraft, and he could get those bombs placed exactly where he wanted them. A really great use of air power and a role for the B-52 that no one ever imagined back in the 1950s.
I don't think anybody imagined that we would also be on horseback. We did a program on that called Horse Soldiers. That was a book written by that very same gentleman. You can go to our archives, folks, at veteransradio.net. That's right, veteransradio.net. Look for programs. Click on that. It might have been about a year ago. Dale was the host of that. Really cool. Way cool. Way cool. And so this, you know, when you think of that dichotomy, the technology, there's somebody on horseback because you still need to get out in there. You still had to get into the desert. Horses were stealth-like, right?
Well, I'm not sure I'd go that far, but they were very capable of what they did.
That's right, and I think that's just amazing to be able to call in a B-52. Okay, we've got a few more minutes. Let's get in to the B-1. How does the B-1 dovetail? Oh, by the way, thank you very much for that on the B-52. Thank you. The number one bomber. Number one. Okay, we dovetail now to the B-1 bomber. I don't know much about the B-1. Would that be called the transitional bomber?
Well, I've got to tell you, the B-1 is probably the best looking of these three bombers. It's very fast. It was designed to have a little bit of a supersonic capability, though that's not used a lot. It's got afterburner. It looks like a great big fighter plane. Beautiful, beautiful aircraft. originally developed in about 1970. The program went on hold for a while and then came back, and so the B-1s we have today, there are 100 of them. They were manufactured in the early 1980s. We've got about 60 left in the force now. And the interesting thing about the B-1, it has only a conventional role. At the moment, due to some arms control treaties from many years ago now, the B-1 is only a conventional bomber. And it actually took over for the B-52 about 5 years ago. The B-52 had continued to do a lot of work in Afghanistan and in Iraq, and so commanders had B-52s on alert all the time for use airborne in Iraq. The B-1 took over that role when the B-52 started doing this continuous bomber presence from Guam and refocusing on the nuclear mission. So here's what a B-1 in Afghanistan can do for you today. I mean, I'm talking right now. This could be going on. If you're a ground controller, you can call and say you'd like a precision bomb, maybe a 500-pound bomb if you don't want a lot of collateral damage, maybe a larger bomb if you have a bigger target to hit. One way that this is used is if our coalition forces are in contact, i.e. in a firefight with the insurgent forces there, they will call in a strike on the insurgent position to help break the fight. You can also ask a B-1 to give you a low-pass show of force. So imagine this. You're on a hillside in Afghanistan. Here comes the B-1 screaming down, possibly an afterburner, at just a few thousand feet. The noise, the impact, the message. And the message is...
Adios.
Adios, and we'll be back with the bomb any time this guy says. So the B-1s are used really frequently for this. They've been doing this operation now for many years. They were used, of course, in the Iraq War in 2003, in the opening of that. They were used from the beginning in Afghanistan. But right now, they are the ones pulling the mission deployed to Southwest Asia to support our ground forces there.
And if you can't get them out of the caves, you do a show of force saying that if you don't get out sometime soon, this is what's going to happen to you. Wow. Show of force. I love it. I love it. I love it. And so the B-1s are being used right now. And how many of those are in our stockpile?
Well, we built 100 originally, and we have about 66 left in the inventory. Of course, some of those will always be in test and modification and in depot. So they think of having, you know, probably about 40 to 50 available at any one particular day.
Okay, take us. Well, I know you talked earlier about the B-2, but now the transition. We got B-1. We went to B-2. How much was the B-1 bomber per unit?
You know, I don't have that exact figure, but the B-1 was done in a kind of a smart way because they built them all at once. They built the number they planned for. They built 100. They did the production within, I think, just over a four-year period. So they were able to get some economies of scale, much as had been done with the B-52. You know, one of the problems with the B-2 was that since only 21 were built, there wasn't time to pay off all the development costs, and that's what makes that number seem real high of the $2 billion, because it cost $40 billion to develop the program. If they bought out 100, the numbers would be much more realistic.
And so the B-2 at $2.5 billion was stopped because of austerity.
It was really stopped because of the end of the Cold War, primarily. It was scheduled to go into higher rate production. It was very technologically advanced for its time. And one thing the B-2 did that a lot of people don't know about is it forced Northrop to develop something called CAD-CAM, which was computer-aided design. So instead of stacks and stacks of blueprints, they actually took the time to put this all on computers in the 1980s. So you can imagine how much work that was, but it made it possible to design the B-2 with its curves. And it also kind of created the foundation for computer-aided design in the whole aircraft industry in America.
Wow, we're out of time. That's right. 60 minutes goes real fast. Dr. Grant, please come back on the program again. You and I talked about getting some pilots. Wouldn't that be cool, huh? Way cool. Isn't that right, Dr. Grant? Can you do that?
Yeah, I've enjoyed talking bombers with you, Bob.
And can you get us some future pilots, and we can have another program on that? How to fly one of these things, right?
Let's do that.
Okay. Thank you very much. You have a great day. Wow. Okay, next week Dale will be back. And the wonderful Nina. Yeah, I've been doing this one solo today. I suppose you can figure that out. And what else we got? Okay, and coming up, Gary Lilly. We're going to be doing a Gary Lilly August 4th, which will be the first anniversary of Gary Lilly. Until then, you are dismissed.